Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, $2.50 plus for a gallon of gas in Iraq. One congressman says the U.S. taxpayers being taken to the cleaners.
A secret trial in Florida raises questions that may go all the way to the Supreme Court.
How do we know that there isn't an entire secret system of justice in the United States that exists at the behest of prosecutors and certain judges? How do we know that?
And author Mary Roach on the importance and curious lives of human cadavers.
These stories and scary movies coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Hospital officials in Iraq say two civilians were killed and 17 injured in a suburb outside of Baghdad today. The deaths occurred as Americans and Iraqi police tried to clear a market stall from a main road after a grenade attack against American soldiers that left two of them wounded. Anti-American protests and gunfire erupted when U.S. armored vehicles moved in. Thousands of Iranians today protested their country's decision to cooperate with the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency. The International Atomic Energy Agency had given Tehran until today to prove that it's not developing nuclear weapons or face possible UN sanctions. From Tehran, NPR's Kate Seeley reports.
Hardliners in Tehran protested what they said was the government's submission to international pressure. Last week, Iran agreed to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA. The decision followed talks with the foreign ministers of Britain, Germany, and France. Iran agreed to open up its nuclear facilities to unlimited UN inspections, temporarily suspend uranium enrichment, and give a full accounting of its nuclear activities. Shortly after, it submitted to the UN nuclear watchdog a massive declaration of its nuclear program. Yesterday, IAEA chief Mohammed El-Baradei said Iran's declaration seemed comprehensive but still had to be verified for accuracy. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Tehran.
Chilly temperatures and dense fog are giving firefighters in Southern California some help. Andrea Tuttle is with the State Department of Forestry. She spoke on NBC's Today Show.
We're cautiously optimistic. Mother Nature is finally starting to help us. The winds are starting to die down. We're hoping that within the week, the hot flames will be died down and we can start the mop-up.
The wildfires have burned nearly 750,000 acres and left at least 20 people dead. Tamara Keith with member station KQED is in San Diego County, where the Cedar Fire has now burned 270,000 acres. It's the largest wildfire in California. She says some roads in the area remain shut down.
Most of the major roads are open. However, the roads that run through these mountainous areas where the Cedar Fire has really taken hold, they're still closed to the regular public. As I was driving on Highway 79, there were trees falling in the road, down power lines. It was really a hazardous course. And officials are concerned that more trees could fall because they've been so damaged by the fire.
Tamara Keith, the member station KQED. Israel is barring foreign airliners that don't have bulletproof cockpit doors from landing at its international airport. The transport ministry says Israel will use onboard inspections to enforce the measure. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 25 points, the Nasdaq up 0.83. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, a new government report shows Americans bought less last month. The Commerce Department says consumers cut their spending by 0.3% in September. Previously, high consumer spending had helped to boost third-quarter economic growth. There are more problems for Canada's insolvent National Air Carrier. The association representing more than 5,000 Canadian travel agents has filed a $1.3 billion lawsuit against Air Canada. Dan Karpinchuk has more from Toronto.
The Canadian Standard Travel Agent Registry, or CSTAR, says the claim for damages goes back to 1997. That's when Air Canada took its first action against travel agents by beginning to lower or cap commissions and eventually to eliminate them. Travel agents say they just want the airline to pay them for what their time is worth. CSTAR's claim is also related to ongoing lawsuits against five large U.S. airlines and the International Air Transport Association. A lawsuit was actually launched against Air Canada a year and a half ago, but it was put on hold when the airline filed for protection from its creditors earlier this year. The travel agents must still win class action status, but no court date to do so has yet been set. A similar suit launched by travel agents in the U.S. was awarded class action status and is expected to go to court early next year. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Russian prosecutor's office said today it had lifted a freeze on 2% stake of oil giant Yukos. The move comes after the Russian government impounded 44% of the firm's assets belonging to its detained chief executive and his friends. It's the latest action in the escalation of a conflict between the Kremlin and Yukos, whose chief executive, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was detained last week and charged with fraud and tax evasion. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
2 weeks ago, we reported that Halliburton Corporation was allegedly overcharging the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for gasoline it bought from Kuwait and imported into Iraq. The price Halliburton charged, $1.70 a gallon. Now, the congressmen who sounded the alarm say the price is actually considerably more, $2.65 a gallon. Joining us on the line from Washington is Henry Waxman, Democratic congressman from California. Welcome, Congressman.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
And thanks for joining us. Now, Congressman, this contract with Halliburton is to supply gas stations with gas until Iraq can produce its own. Halliburton's buying the gas from Kuwait, so isn't Halliburton just paying what they're being charged?
That could well be the case. It could be that Halliburton is overpaying for the gasoline and somebody in Kuwait is making a huge sum of money out of all of this, or Halliburton's pocketing the money. But one thing for sure is that the U.S. taxpayers are overpaying for the gasoline. The state-owned gasoline company in Iraq is bringing in gasoline the same way, and they're paying a dollar a gallon. And here you have Halliburton charging us $2.65 a gallon. So it is really quite astounding that every time anybody buys gasoline in Iraq, the American taxpayers lose.
Has Halliburton explained itself at all?
Halliburton said two things. They've said that they had to enter into short-term contracts to buy the gasoline, so they're paying more than otherwise would be the case.
Mm-hmm.
And they claim that they have an extra cost because of the insecurity of transporting the gasoline into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are two answers to that. One, the U.S. military is escorting the Halliburton convoys into Iraq, so we're also paying for their security. And secondly, why are they such bad managers that they would end up overpaying for the gasoline? I presume if that's the case, it's the mentality that they have that under this contract, whatever costs they incur, they're going to be paid and they're going to make more profits as a result of the extra costs.
Assuming the U.S. taxpayer is being overcharged on all this, why wouldn't the Bush administration do something about it? It would make them look good.
I don't think they are scrutinizing these things because there's a culture in the military of overpaying. We've had a history with Halliburton. This isn't the first time we've dealt with them. They had contracts in Bosnia, and they helped build the prison camps in Guantanamo. They've mm-hmm. been very active in a whole range of activities, and the record is clear. They've overcharged the government on many occasions. In fact, it got so bad that they were facing criminal charges and ended up paying $2 million to settle the case. They were charging us $85 a sheet for plywood that cost $15 for other people. So this is not the first instance. Either it's a culture where they don't care, it's not their money, and I guess if you're in a hotel and you can go to the mini bar and take $5 for a Coke, Coke and somebody else is paying the bill, you might not care. If you had to pay for it, you would go down the street and buy it for a dollar. Well, I think that's, the at best case, the mentality at play here.
To finish up, Congressman, does Halliburton have this contract to supply gasoline to Iraq for good, or is there a rebidding process underway?
Well, that's another interesting aspect, because originally we heard about this a no-bid contract for Halliburton, and they didn't announce it for a month. And then when they announced it, they said, well, it's a no-bid contract because it's only for an emergency short-term to put out oil well fires. Then we inquired further about it, and the more questions we asked, we finally had the Army Corps of Engineers entered into the contract own up to the fact that it was not just a short-term contract. It wasn't just to put out oil well fires. It was a maximum $7 billion contract with many years to run and for them to run the oil industry in Iraq. But when attention was paid to that, they came out and said, "Oh, we're going to rebid the contract. It's only a no bid now, but it's going to be rebid." Well, they just announced within this last week that they're just not ready to have any rebidding. So Halliburton's going to at least go until next year, and they've already made on this contract and the other contract they had with the government for work in Iraq over $3.1 billion.
Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman from California joined us on the line from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Congressman.
Thank you for your interest. Bye-bye.
It's a court case that's been so shrouded in secrecy that the public didn't even know it existed until recently, and it could soon be the first 9/11 case to be heard before the Supreme Court. The case of MKB versus Warden only came to light when a court clerk in Florida made a docketing error last March identifying MKB, the appealing party, who's been free on bond since March of 2002 and appears unlikely to be involved in terrorism. He's asking the Supreme Court to consider his question, why the secrecy? Joining us on the line is Warren Ritchie. He's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. And Warren, how secret is this? Why is this so interesting to court observers like you?
Well, what's unusual here is that judges have the power to seal certain portions of a judicial proceeding, or they can hold entire hearings behind closed doors. But they usually explain that in public. They say, we need to go into a secret session because of reasons of national security or because trade secrets are at stake.
Or we're protecting a drug dealer who's also been a witness or cases like that.
Yes, there are reasons, and it's usually explained in the public record. With the one exception, the very brief mistake by a docketing clerk, this case has been conducted entirely behind closed doors.
What do we know about this case and this man?
It's known that he was detained by the INS and that at some point the FBI wanted to question him, and so he was held and he was questioned. And then he filed a habeas corpus petition, which went into federal court, and that entire proceeding, and of course all of the proceedings in immigration court are secret.
And remind us, habeas corpus is?
This is the right that individuals have to basically force the government to justify why it's holding someone.
So as we said, this man, he's reportedly an Algerian waiter. His case is making it to the Supreme Court. Do you think they'll hear it?
Actually, the first question that will probably come up is whether or not the Supreme Court will require the Justice Department to file a response. The Justice Department doesn't want to file a response to this. They want the Supreme Court just to reject the case and to let things go on as they have. And so what will happen, the justices will sit down a week from today and discuss this case, and probably what they'll discuss is whether or not to request that the Justice Department file a response. Then they will reach that question of whether or not this case should be heard.
Hmm. By the way, you write that this type of secrecy, everyone involved in the case has been sworn to secrecy, is unprecedented. How would we know that if any that preceded it was in secret?
Yes, that's right. Well, that's exactly right. How do we know? How do we know how many of these cases are out there? How do we know that there isn't an entire secret system of justice in the United States that exists at the behest of prosecutors and certain judges and that defense attorneys are sworn to secrecy. How do we know that? The entire process is hidden from public view, and that is very unusual.
Well, Warren Ritchie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Warren Ritchie, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He may have led NASA, but Daniel Golden will most likely not lead Boston University. Golden is reported to have withdrawn from the position a week after the executive committee of the school's Board of Trustees took a vote of no confidence in his appointment. The whole Board of Trustees is expected to take up the issue today. Golden was to take over leadership of the school from outgoing John Silber tomorrow. The controversy surrounding Golden makes for compelling drama, but also leaves people wondering about the nature of the job. By the way, in the interest of full disclosure, Boston University holds the license to this radio station. Joining us is Professor Judith McLaughlin of Harvard's Graduate School of Education, right across the river from BU. Welcome, Professor.
Hello.
And tell us, what, in your opinion, happened here?
Well, it's a very complicated story, and happily an unusual one. One unusual part of this story is that we have a president continuously, at least at the institution, if not continuously in the role of president, for 32 years.
This is John Silber,
yes,
who was known as a hands-on micromanager. He controlled every aspect of university life. He has fierce supporters and critics.
And he had a board over 32 years, after working with him for 32 years, that could be said to be his board.
How does that affect a school?
Trustees serve in a position where they can hire and fire a president, as we certainly see in this case. They have a responsibility for the long-term good of the institution. They must maintain some independence, even as while they are educated by the president, they must have ways to learn about the institution apart from having it all channeled through one person. And they must be able to assess and evaluate what's going on at the institution and how well the president is doing. In a situation such as BU, where a president has probably been responsible for the appointment of every trustee, that independence from the president, that ability to have a perspective other than through the president's eyes, was probably lost here.
How much does this affect the university?
Well, I think in the short run, it's a black eye, an embarrassment, a kind of public attention that no institution wants. But I think it's more than that. There are very, very serious questions that will linger at BU for a long time about responsibility, accountability, about the kind of management and leadership that was exercised at the university for a very long time. So I think this is very bad news for this institution. It is a longstanding, well-regarded university with some excellent faculty and, you know, very good students. Can it recover from this? I think so. I hope so.
But as you said, pretty much isolated to this university and not part of a trend.
BU has always had an unusually strong president, a president who had much more power than was typical. In one very real sense, I think they picked someone who was used to being the kind of leader that Silber was. And this is not the typical college university president. Most presidents have much less power than people outside the institution assume. They are as often a facilitator and a negotiator as they are able to be someone who has kind of control over the institution.
So you're saying that while the national debate goes on as to what exactly a college president, a university president should do, in this particular instance, it seems as if John Silber helped pick a man much like himself and then didn't like it.
Right. I mean, you had a battle of the titans in some senses with two enormously strong personalities.
Well, Professor, thank you.
Okay.
Judith McLaughlin, Educational Chair of the Harvard Seminar for New Presidents at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Mm-hmm.
by the way, Boston University does hold the license to the station we're broadcasting from, WBUR, not yours if you're listening to us around the country. Just ahead, real-life tales of how the dead help the living, the curious lives of human cadavers.
And later in the program, the fictional version, the scariest movies of all time.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Most of us try to be reasonably useful when we're alive. But you might be surprised how many uses there are for you when you're dead. Well, just in time for Halloween, we're joined now by Mary Roach. Her recent book is called Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. Mary joins us on the phone from her home in San Francisco. And Mary, welcome, I think.
Thank you, Bill.
Mary, decapitation, cannibalism, human decay. How in the world did you end up writing a book about corpses?
I wish I had a handy answer, like I come from a long line of morticians and or something like that. It actually it grew out of a Salon column that I did on health, medicine, the human body, and kind of a humorous approach to the topics. So it grew out of there, which still doesn't answer your question, why would I be interested in such things?
Well, the lighter side of cadavers, that's one way to get into it, I guess. Your book begins, Mary, with a striking sequence. We thought we'd have you read just a bit of that very first paragraph. Tell us first where you were and then read that paragraph.
Yeah, I was down in Texas at a practice seminar for plastic surgeons, and I had actually thought they would be practicing on entire cadavers, but I was mistaken, and you'll see why. The human head is of the same approximate size and weight as a roaster chicken. I have never before had occasion to make the comparison, for never before today have I seen a head in a roasting pan. But here are 40 of them, one per pan, resting face up on what looks to be a small pet food bowl. The heads have been put in roasting pans, which are of the disposable aluminum variety, for the same reason chickens are put in roasting pans, to catch the drippings.
Wow. The first question is whether you were able to look at these human heads and not sort of run from the room, and what kind of emotions it threw up in you, and what the heck are they using the human heads for?
To answer the first part of your question, when I first walked in the room, all I could see was the tops of the heads. But then I started to move down the rows between the tables. Then you sort of saw the, for want of a better word, the stump of the neck where they'd cut the head off. And that was a little, that was quite disturbing. You know, this is the first time I'd seen something like that. And what my brain decided to do with this information was decide that, well, this was a Halloween mask factory, and these people were just working on masks, and these weren't really heads. You tend to, your brain.
Denial.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet, in so much of your book, including this question of the heads, there's a real good purpose to the use of a lot of cadavers.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This particular seminar, they were learning some new techniques. And this is quite commonly done when surgeons need to learn, say, you know, a new endoscopic technique or some sort of a shoulder replacement or something. They want to do a few run-throughs on a patient who's not going to, you know, wake up in a few hours and go, you know, this doesn't quite feel right. So it really is, considering the alternative, a very good thing to do.
Well, just to prove to our listeners that we're not just trying to be ghoulish here, tell me about other really important uses for the dead.
Yeah, here's one that a lot of people aren't familiar with, and it was a lot more common in the 60s. Crash test dummies, in the early days, they had to calibrate them because the dummy itself would just tell you how much force a crash was unleashing.
Yeah.
And they needed to know, well, does, you know, that much force to a chest, what does that do?
Yeah.
So they actually, there was a science called impact tolerance where they would, you know, figure out how much the human body could take in a crash so that they would make cars that wouldn't exceed that amount.
Mm-hmm.
Also, airbag testing and seatbelt testing, things like that.
Helped solve the mystery of TWA Flight 800?
Yes. These are not donated bodies. These are actually the victims of a plane crash. When there's a flight that goes down and they can't recover the black box or there's some controversy as to what happened and why the plane crashed, sometimes the bodies are actually recruited. They look at the injuries and they have a seating chart so they know which body had been seated where, and they look for clusters of certain telltale injuries. For example, if there were a bomb, you'd see a lot of fragmentation of bodies right close to it. If there was a fire that swept through the cabin, they can sort of trace the direction of the fire by looking where the burns were, which side of the body, that sort of thing.
And the use of corpses and cadavers has a venerable history, too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The early days, no one donated their body to science. That whole concept didn't exist. In fact, the only bodies they could get legally were executed murderers. Those were turned over to the anatomy labs. The rest of them were actually stolen from cemeteries by these part-time thugs called body snatchers who would go out late at night after a funeral, take the body over to the anatomy schools, and they collected a pretty handsome fee.
And of course, very fundamentally, what we know about the human body is from studying cadavers. Leonardo da Vinci did it and so many others.
Absolutely, yes.
It can be an act of tremendous generosity and even compassion when somebody leaves their body to be studied by the living.
One of the most heroic things that happens every day is when someone decides, yes, I want to be an organ donor. I actually witnessed a harvesting of organs, somebody who was brain dead. You know, this woman was dead, and yet her kidneys, liver, and heart were going to three different people whose lives would then be extended. And I thought that's a level of heroics most of us don't achieve when we're alive.
Mary, did all this exposure to the dead human body change your view about death at all?
I'm not profoundly altered having done the book, but one thing, something about seeing a cadaver on a table, there's something about the finality of that and just the deadness of the person that you find yourself thinking there's just got to be something more, because it's such an anticlimax to a life to just end up, that's it, there you are. You get this real sense that something left and went someplace else. It's just an intuitive thing. I can't say I'm a deeply religious person now, but it really does make you think.
It's a very intriguing book, and it's about the dead, but it's very much also about the living. Mary Roach, thanks very much for joining us on it.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Mary Roach is the author of the new book, Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers.
Next week on Here and Now, the first openly gay Episcopal bishop will be installed. We'll have a report on his consecration and the expected protests.
And an ambitious program to present the history, the whole history of Jewish music in America.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the government's numbers say the economy is picking up. We'll see if those numbers really reflect what's going on in two places outside the Beltway.
And Halloween video pics. You may have seen Silence of the Lambs, but what about 1963's Blood Feast?
I do cater to unusual affairs.
What do you recommend?
Have you ever had an Egyptian feast?
Blood Feast, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and other thriller films on Halloween.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. A U.S. Special Forces soldier has died of wounds he suffered in fighting in southern Afghanistan. It is the third U.S. death in Afghanistan in less than a week. Just yesterday, the United Nations says it has temporarily suspended road missions in parts of southern Afghanistan because of attacks on humanitarian workers. A U.S. soldier from the 82nd Airborne Division was killed in a bomb attack today near the Iraqi town of Qadiya in the hostile Sunni Triangle area west of Baghdad. The attack brought to 118 the number of U.S. soldiers killed in action since President Bush declared major combat in Iraq over. During the war in Iraq in March and April, 114 U.S. soldiers were killed in combat. On the outskirts of Baghdad today, clashes between Iraqis waving pictures of Saddam Hussein and U.S. troops. Two civilians were killed. Two U.S. soldiers were wounded. In Fallujah, a powerful explosion and fire struck the mayor's office, targeted because of alleged cooperation with Americans. Legislation giving President Bush the money he wants for Iraq and Afghanistan is zipping its way through Congress. The House approved the $87.5 billion measure early this morning, shortly after midnight. The Senate plans to vote on it Monday. It appears Americans have tempered those recent spending binges. The Commerce Department reports consumer spending posted its biggest drop in a year last month, dipping 0.3%. The decline in personal spending comes after gains in the two previous months. Mother Nature has become more cooperative in California, where cooler temperatures and dense fog are helping firefighters who are continuing to battle massive wildfires. Matt Brandt with the California Department of Forestry says firefighters understand the dangers of battling the flames, but they're also concerned about getting homeowners out of harm's way.
It's a risky job, so we know the risks going in, and we just if we come across injuries, we'll deal with those. And our main concern is for them that they're safe. Their homes can be rebuilt, and I know they have their possessions there, but their lives can't be replaced. So that's our main concern.
After a week of fires, 20 people have been killed, more than 2,800 homes destroyed, and nearly 750,000 acres charred. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are high. The Dow is up 32 points at 98.19. The Nasdaq is up 3 points at 19.35. And the S&P is up 4 points at 10.51.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Where you live and how you live. Did the U.S. economy's ferocious pace in the third quarter matter? Did you notice the 7.2% growth, expansion not seen in 20 years? And in the bottom line department, did you find a job if you needed one? Well, we thought we'd take a look at the economy this morning at two diverse places in the country with two members of our editorial roundtable.
Joining us on the line is first Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Bill.
And Guy McMillan. He's editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Bill.
Guy, let's start with the nitty-gritty jobs. We happen to pick up that the Times News of Twin Falls, Idaho, reports that job ads in that paper are down 13% from last year. What about your paper?
Well, I don't have a percentage figure, but they're down. They're down significantly. It's a problem for the economy. It's also a problem for the newspaper because we rely a lot on these. And I noticed in yesterday's newspaper we had more Personals Network ads than we did Help Wanted. So.
Randy, how about out in Flagstaff?
We've had a layoffs, actually, at the local university and the school district. We're dependent on government jobs here a lot. The only growth area has been in forestry and putting out forest fires, unfortunately. So we're down, I would say.
So, Randy, when the headlines are all about 7.2% growth, and that's the biggest growth since the mid-'80s, do you feel that in your community? Is it obvious that the economy is a house of fire?
No. In fact, it took us by surprise, I'd have to say. I mean, we also read the news about the massive layoffs coming up at Sony and other big corporations, and we wonder, I guess, when it's going to arrive here and if it's going to last.
Yeah, I think everybody was surprised by those figures yesterday, including all of the economists. Everybody was kind of trying to figure out why, if this economy is burgeoning along like that, we're having so little job growth. In fact, I guess we've lost jobs during the period that the economy supposedly was roaring ahead.
Right, Guy. And all the economists who understand these things or make attempts to explain them say that it was about consumer spending.
Yeah, well, I can explain that. My kitchen stove crashed in August, and I had to buy a new stove, which was a huge expense. And I think that, more than the Bush tax cut, actually explained the economy around here.
The big marker here, by the way, is tour buses that enter the Grand Canyon, and they're still way down since September 11, 2001.
Well, to stick with what we hear from the economists, apparently it was the tax cuts, they say. People bought, in fact, big-ticket items. They fixed their kitchens. They grabbed the tax cut. They bought cars. They bought TVs. They bought appliances. But then last month, they didn't do that.
We didn't see a whole lot of increase in some of the big-ticket purchases like cars here. Our jobless rate's been hovering around 5%. And I think that the worry here is that as we move into the winter months and the effect of the tax rebates wears off, it's just going to go back to a fairly slow economy.
Yeah, I look at the Help Wanted ads here in Keene, New Hampshire, and I see a variety of ads, but not very many of them. I mean, we have everything from flag persons at $9 an hour to an ad for an ophthalmic scrub, whatever that is, you know, everything in between. I think what we don't have, however, are large numbers of openings, and most of the expansion around here is in retail.
Guy, there are a lot of issues out there, but perhaps two main issues. The economy, we've been discussing it, and that gets so confusing. The other big issue that also gets confusing, it's Iraq. What is the mood in your neck of the woods at the moment on Iraq?
Oh, I think people are holding their breath. This is something that has never been wildly popular in the Northeast, and it's getting less popular by the day. And I don't think anybody has any great solutions. There's not a real move to pull out there. We've made a commitment, or at least the country has. But people are afraid.
Randy, is the attention of your readers, you think, drifting away from, you know, this drip of soldiers killed over there that we talk about?
Well, here in Arizona, the polls show still a majority support for the president and for his policies. I think there is a lot of interest because we have still some soldiers over there. This is a community that I think is interested in the foreign policy aspects, but is also interested in the way that the president is conducting you know, his policies about the economy. So I don't know. I think it's a wash right now, Bill.
Yeah, there's a lot of murkiness out there on both these issues. Either one of you, is there anything where you live that's going well? Are there any industries that are emerging? Is there any reason for optimism where you live this fall?
Well, we have a huge retail boom here. I don't know whether it's optimistic or not, but we have in this community, which is a community of about 23,000 people, we have several huge stores coming in here. So somebody's optimistic. I mean, we just got our first Home Depot. We're getting these big bookstores and clothing stores, and there's more on the table, more applications.
You do see that, don't you, Randy? You see things being built. The housing market is strong. It just gets awfully confusing, the economy racing along and yet jobs so difficult to find. What's the good news in Flagstaff?
Well, you know, it's kind of it's sad to say, but the fires and the poor state of the forests here have created a boom in forestry and in the growth of the small diameter wood mills around here, using the wood that they're taking out to try to prevent the forest fires.
I can't let this conversation end without hearing about Keene, New Hampshire's pumpkins.
Well, I'm here to tell you. We're Pumpkin City, USA. We broke our own record last weekend, 28,952 carved pumpkins all in one place in our downtown square. And I'm not sure what 28,952 pumpkins is worth in terms of the value of a community, but by golly, we're proud of it.
So these 28,952 pumpkins are jack-o'-lanterns. You'll light them up too, huh?
Yeah, these are all carved pumpkins, and some of them rather dramatically so. What happens is people bring them in from this community and from surrounding areas, and they put them on these huge display things. They look almost like bleachers at a sporting event, and they're all lit up at once, and it is really spectacular. I can't tell you, I don't know how this started. It's been about 10 years now, but it really is quite the event.
Let's thank you both for a conversation on everything from pumpkins to the economy to Iraq. Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Bill.
And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona.
My pleasure, Bill.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And you can mail us a letter. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from.
Still to come, ghoulish and terrifying and really funny, scary films for Halloween weekend.
You're listening to Here and Now.
I've kept a tattered magazine article for years. It was written by Stephen Glass of the New Republic and described a Monica Lewinsky paraphernalia booth at a convention. I even interviewed Stephen Glass about it. It was a great story. Too great. Stephen Glass fabricated all or part of 27 articles for the New Republic. He was eventually found out and fired. Now his story is being told in his novel, The Fabulist, and in a new movie, Shattered Glass. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Charles Lane, the former editor of the New Republic, who eventually investigated Glass and found the truth about the Monica Lewinsky paraphernalia booth. Hello there.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, it didn't exist.
Yes, that's right.
What happened? I mean, did you have any sense at all as his editor that he might have been making things up?
There were some rumors, and there had been little hints here and there, but I never was aware in any conscious way that he was a fake until we were, you know, kind of alerted to a problem with one story by some journalists from Forbes, and I started to investigate, and then it very quickly became evident that he'd been faking a lot of things.
And which story was that?
This was a story called Hack Heaven. It ran in the May 18, 1998 New Republic, and it was ostensibly a story about a teenage hacker who'd extorted money from a software company. It went in to the magazine. It had been fact-checked and everything, and when I looked into it further, it turned out absolutely not a word of it was true.
And people would say, how could that happen if it was fact-checked? I mean, wouldn't you, in the Monica Lewinsky case, call the convention and see if they had a booth that sold Monica Lewinsky's berets or... How does it happen?
Well, I don't think the New Republic's fact-checking was as thorough as it should have been, but I also think that people shouldn't overestimate how much time and money the New Republic at that time had to devote to fact-checking. There was a very small number of people, sometimes only two people a week, fact-checking the entire magazine, and They were all overloaded, and Steve was a friend and trusted, and he was there all the time, and he had been a fact checker himself, and he knew how the system worked. And between the combination of lack of resources, trust, and somebody who knew how to beat the system, it all got through.
Could you tick off for us some of the other stories that weren't true, just the headlines?
He wrote a false story about people who worshipped George Bush, the first one who was president. He wrote another false story about young conservatives engaging in all kinds of drug abuse and sexual misbehavior. He wrote a lot of false stories. I don't think you have enough time on the show to go through all of them.
Yeah. And now the subject of his own book and a movie. Does that grate a little bit? Because it's fame. It might be infamous, but it's fame.
Well, I don't think the movie is going to glorify Steve Glass. People who see the movie have uniformly walked out with a negative view of what he did. The book is another story. I mean, he claims it's fiction, but it's clearly a Romano Clay. Some of the details in it are derived from experiences that I know about firsthand, and they're basically just transmitted from what really happened. So he's attempting in that book to kind of offer his own combination of mea culpa and a little bit of, you know, some excuses for what he did.
One last question. Your role in all of this, do you feel duped?
Well, I did until I wasn't. You know, I sort of stopped being duped at a certain point, and then I now feel like nothing, I would never, ever believe anything he says again, no matter how trivial. I just feel like there's that old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Yeah, fool me 27 times.
And shame on, really shame on me.
Yeah. Charles Lane, thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thanks a lot, Robin.
Charles Lane, former editor of the New Republic magazine, now a writer for the Washington Post.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's Halloween. Time to suit up. By the way, Lord of the Rings Renaissance outfits are this year's hot costumes, but there's also a curious rise in fairy outfits. Anyway, if you have to stay home to dish out the candy and still want a thrill, there are a whole host of videos to put you in the mood. Here with some suggestions, we're joined by Here and Now's film critics Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Robin. Robin.
Eric, are you going as a Texas chainsaw murderer?
No, I think I'll probably go as something somewhat kindler and gentler.
That is one of your favorites, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a favorite. It's a great film. You know, we currently have the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre in theaters, but I say, you know, why bother with a remake when the 1974 original was still the best? In some measure, because it's a movie that can alternately be hilarious or terrifying, depending on your mood and who you're seeing it with and so on. And it's also a movie that really works extremely well because of the soundtrack. This is one of the creepiest soundtracks ever recorded, such as when one of the victims is rummaging through this old abandoned, or what she thinks is an abandoned house, and stumbles into a room filled with bones and feathers and chickens suspended in a tiny cage from a wire.
Thank you.
It's a gritty, claustrophobic film that really grates on you in a lot of ways, and the soundtrack certainly plays a big role in that.
Oh, great, a movie that grates on us.
Well, what do you want it out of?
Exactly. It's a genre. It's horror. And there's another one that's also been remade, but I'm guessing you're going to say the same thing. Why bother?
Yeah, I think that's the case. Invasion of the Body Snatchers is a movie that's been remade a couple of times, but again, go back to the original from 1956, this Cold War paranoid science fiction thriller. It's still one of the great classics. A small-town doctor, Miles Bennell, who's played by Kevin McCarthy, returns home, and he finds that everybody's behaving a bit differently. They're emotionless. In this scene, his friend Teddy finds that the body they've all discovered that's been sort of a blank is beginning to take on the characteristics of her husband. The paranoia and the hysteria just increase and increase in this movie, and it's a great roller coaster ride.
And it reminds us, Renee, did women have different voices back then or something? Women in old horror movies have a scream and a voice that it doesn't get duplicated.
A lot higher. No, the shrieks were just better. It's just
something.
The way things were then.
Well, Renee, you have your favorites as well.
Horror Hotel. It's a film from 1960, black and white, very small budget, and just the right combination of cheesiness and chills. Mm-hmm. It's mainly set in Whitewood, Massachusetts, which is actually a stand-in for Salem. And a college student goes there to research witchcraft.
A treatise on devil worship in New England. Do you find this interesting?
Why, it's fascinating. The things I've learnt. Listen to this. On Candlemas Eve, a coven of witches gathered beneath the Raven's Inn to perform a black mass in the honor of Lucifer. The witch, Elizabeth Selwyn, marked a young girl for sacrifice by obtaining an object of value belonging to her with which to call her. The witches sacrificed her on the altar and drank her blood at the hour of 13. What's the hour of 13?
Well, personally, I have never heard a clock strike more than 12. Now, how about joining the dancing?
In a little while, I promise. Oh, by the way, I seem to have misplaced my locket.
You can almost hear the ghosts rubbing their palms together in glee.
It's a bit of a film that has a cult following. I first saw this film in 1970 when I was 8 years old on Creature Features, which used to come on New York TV.
I remember that. Was the guy who had a coffin with his mother in it or something?
It was just the craziest thing. Every Saturday night they'd have a different film. And I watched this film with my mother and my sister, and it got to this one crucial moment. I remember I actually ran from the room and ended up watching the Jackie Gleason show with my aunt in the basement. And the movie is still really unnerving. A big part of that's because it has all this religious imagery. God comes up a lot in this whole battle between God and the devil. And as a good, you know, church-raised, God-fearing girl, it just freaked me out no end. And still does.
Well, you have another favorite, too, that freaked me out at the time as well.
Silence of the Lambs. Here's a film I'm guessing everyone does their own really bad Hannibal Lecter imitation, but people probably haven't seen the entire film in a while. It came out in 1991, of course, won a slew of Oscars. But it really is this unsettling, disturbing film. And I remember when the film came out, it was especially unsettling because it came out the same year as people began to learn about the crimes of Jeffrey Dahmer. Mm. So here you had the serial killer who'd done all these horrific things, and suddenly the big movie was about serial killers.
Look at him, Starling. Tell me what you see.
Oh, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups. He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment.
Why?
What he does with them takes privacy. He's in his 30s or 40s. He's got real physical strength combined with an older man's self-control. He's cautious, precise, and he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Why not?
He's got a real taste for it now, and he's getting better at his work.
Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs. By the way, I can just hear people starting to write emails. We know these films, the horror genre, they're responsible for the end of Western civilization as we know it. They're gory. They often victimize women. But what is it about them that grips us so?
There's something to being scared in a very safe way. it's fun because it's safe. It's not happening to you.
Exactly. And I think if you're familiar with the conventions, you often sort of laugh along with the movies or even laugh at them, too. So it can be a release in that way as well.
Eric, I know you have a surprise for us.
Yeah. This is the 40th anniversary of the original Gore film from 1963. Blood Feast.
Oh,
and so I figured we couldn't go by without mentioning this movie, produced by David F. Friedman and directed by Herschel Gordon Lewis. It is a low-budget cheese fest. It is absolutely laughable today. But at the time it came out, it was really pushing the envelopes in terms of disembowelments and lopped-off limbs. But it all looks incredibly fake today. This ridiculous story about a cannibalistic Egyptian caterer plying his trade in Florida.
I want something unusual, something totally different.
Yes, Mrs. Fremont, I do cater to unusual affairs. What do you consider to be unusual?
Oh, I don't know. What do you recommend?
Have you ever had an Egyptian feast?
Why, that would be fine. That would be perfect.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the level that we're working on in Blood Feast. It's sort of one of those movies that's in the so bad, it's good, it's funny category.
Renee, one more from you.
Other film I wanted to mention was the original Vanishing, not the bad remake that was the American remake that starred Jeff Bridges and Sandra Bullock, but the original from 1988. And it operates on this very simple premise. A couple is out for a day. They stop at a gas station. He pumps gas into the car. She goes into a convenience store to get something to drink, and she disappears. It's so frightening because it's so slight, and just in the way that you always wonder when you see someone walk away if you're going to see them again and what happens to them. And the movie is about the young man trying to find out what happened to his girlfriend.
And it's in Dutch, and so...
It's in Dutch, so...
we won't be hearing it right now.
We won't be hearing it now, but I highly recommend it. It's a really creepy, unsettling film.
Well, you know, we took an informal poll. I remembered Repulsion, mm-hmm. Don't Look Now, The Bad Seed, 13 Ghosts. In our office, there was also the original Halloween, Poltergeist, Vampyr, a silent movie,
right.
Carrie, and the new Ben Affleck and J-Lo film. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
I think that was a different kind of horror. Well, we're sure you have your favorites out there. For Eric's and Renee's, just remember you can go to our website. We'll have the list for you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Here now, film critics Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham. To see that list of their picks, go to our website, here-now.org.
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
So scared. Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
The country's first openly gay Episcopal bishop is installed in New Hampshire. We'll have a report.
And an ambitious program to present the sweep and history of Jewish music in America.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.